Hello, I'm Alex Amon, your non-binary host, and this is the 57th episode of The Art of Asymmetrical Warfare. Today I'll talk about the fate of Protestants in Ireland during the Irish Civil War. As some of you may know, if you follow me on TikTok, I'm currently receiving treatment for an existing condition, which is why my episode production schedule has been a little off. It's nothing life-threatening, but I had to take time off from work. I'm currently working with insurance to apply for short-term disability. They gave me half of what I was expecting, so I'm trying to fight them on that. And it would be tremendously helpful if you joined my Patreon, Art of Asymmetrical Warfare, right now, as that is really my only source of active income I have at the moment. If you don't like Patreon, you can donate to my Ko-Fi, Pepper the Phoenix, and I have a Venmo as well, Pepper the Phoenix. Every little bit helps, seriously. And now that the betting for money part is over, it's time for making history. If you don't know, Chicago is experiencing an influx of refugees sent here without any preparation because of assholes like Abbott and Biden, who refuses to do anything to address the issue except support Trump's terrible racist policies. Because of our government's unwillingness to do anything useful, 2,200 people are currently sleeping in police stations and O'Hare Lobby, and 9,300 people are living in city shelters all over Chicago. If that wasn't bad enough, Brandon Johnson, our so-called progressive mayor, has signed an agreement with Garda World to build tent camps in Chicago, the same tent camps currently used on the border that have led to disease, abuse, and death of not just adults, but children as well. The contract that Brandon Johnson wants to sign is going to cost Chicagoans $29 million for tents. Garda World is notorious for its human rights abuses, and their site in El Paso, Texas, was cited by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services for substandard living conditions and insufficiently trained staff, which led to children being abused, suffer panic attacks, trauma, and the spread of disease. BBC also found cases of sexual abuse, COVID and lice outbreaks, no clean clothes, and hungry children being served undercooked meat at the same facility. I'll provide a link to the Block Club Chicago article. By the way, Block Club Chicago is an awesome news source with all this information and more in the description. But even if the hired company was great, let's just say Garda World wasn't Garda World, it was some other magically great camp building facility. It makes no sense to spend $29 million on tents when we could spend that money supporting the numerous mutual aid groups that have been created by the people of Chicago to house, feed, and support refugees, asylees, immigrants, and those without houses. This could have been the perfect opportunity for Brandon Johnson to invest in infrastructure that could help not only refugees seeking aid, but our growing population of people without houses or shelter. Instead, Brandon Johnson has decided to invest in the existing system where we provide barely adequate housing for a vulnerable population and withhold all aid that could help them. And it's not like he didn't have other options. There are numerous, you're going to hear about a lot of them in this section, there are numerous of mutual aid organizations that have not only been helping refugees, but have been petitioning the government, first Lori Lightfoot's government and now Brandon Johnson's government, to give them the support they need. Like, help them, give them money, because there was one organization, Toro Paris Toro, Todo para Todos, leased a building to help provide shelter for refugees and then worked with them to find apartments and find job. And they had to get rid of the building because of insurance issues, and they just didn't have the money or the permits to own the building. The city could have helped, but they didn't. Instead, they want to spend $29 million to basically a detention facility company to build tent camps. And it's so dumb because people without houses can't have tents, right? Like, police tear those tents down. But when the government wants to do it, then it's fine. It boggles the mind. So how can we help? So first, you can sign this letter from actionnetwork.org. Ask Mayor Brandon Johnson to cancel the Garda World contract. After you sign the letter, Todo para Todos created a script that you can use to email call your alder asking them to cancel the Garda World contract. Todo Para Todos is one of the mutual aid groups that has been fighting with the city to get more support, and they've created a link tree with a number of ways you can help. I'll provide a link to the link tree specifically, but the ways you can help include supporting the D12 Police Station Migrant Support Response Team. This isn't supporting the police. This is supporting the 200 plus people currently living in the police station because they have nowhere else to go. This org currently has an Amazon wish list where you can buy things for immigrants and refugees and asylees, and they are also accepting donations of clothing, accessories, bedding, books, shoes, and housewares at 2123 South Ashland Avenue, Chicago, Illinois, 60608, Sunday to Wednesday from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., and Thursday, 12 p.m. to 5 p.m. And on their website, there's also a place where you can donate directly to the organization. Todo Para Todos has a site where there are numerous fundraisers for refugees and asylees and immigrants to find housing. And so you can either, I'll provide a link both to their website and then the fundraiser site. You can either donate to an existing fundraiser or you can start your own fundraiser. The Refugee Community Connection. So this is a mutual aid group that Never Again Chicago is working with, and by extension, I am working with. This mutual aid group is looking for volunteers, donations, and welcoming teams for incoming refugees, asylees, and immigrants. The way that it's been working for Never Again is that we just have a really big group of like 12 people, and that we just have a group chat, and basically the Refugee Community Connection assigns you a family that you can help, and you'll get requests for aid, like they need help going to finding out where the grocery stores are, or, you know, they need to go to the hospital, or they need food, or they need housing, or whatever. And then the group chat, we just text the ask, and then we just support however we can. Block Club Chicago, again, great organization, has a great article listing several mutual aid organizations that need our support, and I'll provide a link in the description. But these organizations include Instituto del Progreso Latino, who has an Amazon wish list and are asking for donations of diapers and baby formula, among other items, at their drop-off bots on 2520 Southwestern Avenue. This organization is also providing legal services to incoming refugees, asylees, and immigrants. They are accepting online donations as well. The Pilsen Food Pantry on 1850 South Throop Street is always looking for donations. They are also accepting direct online donations. Southwest Collective is accepting donations at their suite on 6500 West Archer Avenue. Lakeview Lutheran Church has launched a GoFundMe to raise money to buy things such as transportation cards, phones, and SIM cards. Nourishing Hope is a food pantry that serves people with Spanish language services in Humboldt Park, and they are also accepting donations online. Community Health is a volunteer-based health center working with uninsured immigrants to provide medical care free of charge. They are also accepting donations online. Thirdly, Indivisible Chicago has created a new subgroup called the Indivisible Chicago Alliance, which is focusing on immigration. They are asking for volunteers to be part of this alliance so they can work with mutual aid communities and immigrant communities and refugee communities to help actually address this issue the right way. Finally, there's an absolutely amazing group called Respond Crisis Translation, who offer translation services to refugees, immigrants, and asylees at absolutely no charge. So like a lot of times what will happen is that refugees will have to work with governmental officials who don't speak the language that they speak. And so what will happen is that a lot of refugees will come in, you know, they can't speak the language, the official can't speak the language, and the translators that they have on call are either too few or they're actually not really good at translating. And so now there's this push to use AI, which is going to make things worse because Google Translate is still terrible. And so like AI is not going to be better. So Respond Crisis Translation was created to address this gap in the process. And they are working basically free. Like, I got to talk to them this summer through Never Again, and their entire staff is volunteer. I think they have like two people who are paid. But they're responding to requests for translation services almost 24/7. And they're offering languages that normally wouldn't be covered. So they're offering a lot of the indigenous languages from South America. And they make calls on their Instagram all the time. I think the latest call is like Nepalese translator, Malaysian. Like they're trying to find translators who are willing to do this pro bono to help refugees, asylees, and immigrants. Their help is vital to ensuring that refugees, asylees, and immigrants understand the immigration process and what is being asked of them and what is being offered to them. And it will make, if they can communicate effectively, then their ability to resettle will increase exponentially. I'll provide a link to their link tree, which provides different ways you can help. But really, the big thing is to donate to them. Because like I said, they're mostly working for free, and the work they do is so important and so revolutionary in the realm of immigrant care and our stupid immigrant system. Like, it's dumb how revolutionary the concept of, like, let's get people who understand other languages to talk to people who speak to other languages is, but it is. And really, their work is just foundational. Like, please, please, please donate to them. They are amazing. And now, time to talk about a different group of refugees, the Protestants of Ireland. When we think of violence against Irish Protestants, we most likely think of Northern Ireland. But there were hundreds of thousands of Protestants who lived and live still in what is now Ireland, or the Free Irish State, or the Irish Republic. Similar to their Catholic brethren in Northern Ireland, the Protestants were abandoned by all authorities to their fates. The number of Protestants in Ireland had been on decline since 1911. They started the decade with 327,179 people, and then went down to 220,723 people by 1926, amounting to an approximately 33% drop. During the same time span, the Catholic population only fell by 2%. Some historians, such as Peter Hart, argue that at least 50% of the Protestants who left were forced to or risked violent retaliation, while other historians, such as Andy Bielenberg, argue that many Protestants left because of the lack of economic opportunities and the uncertainty of their own futures without British protection. Other explanations include wealthier Protestants wanting to keep their property, but maybe wanting to live in other parts of the British Empire or the United States for various reasons, such as health, employment, education, and marriage prospects for children, etc. More Protestants volunteered for World War I than Catholics, since so many died during the war and their families needed to relocate to be with family elsewhere, or members of a family died during the Spanish flu and had to resettle with other relatives. The violence of both the Irish War of Independence and the Irish Civil War also most certainly contributed to people immigrating. The provisional government paid a lot of lip service to being a nation of all religious denominations, but given everything else it was contending with, it didn't make any special effort to assist the Protestant minority. James Craig, Prime Minister of Northern Ireland, admitted that he didn't think about the Protestants in the South, far more concerned with protecting the North. While the provisional government wasn't openly hostile to the Protestant community, their actions, such as pushing for land reform, did little to assure the Protestants that they would be welcomed or safe. It's most likely safe to say that the Protestant migration was influenced by real acts of violence, the perceived threat or risk of violence, and the expected or actual loss of economic opportunities. Part 1. Economic factors for mass Protestant emigration. Not surprisingly, when the British colonized Ireland, they changed the economy of the island. They built an economic system that was dependent on and maintained England, the landlords, who were usually Protestant, and the British soldiers stationed in the area. This could look like three different situations. Generating wealth for the landowners by owning land, particularly the big houses that remind me kind of the plantations in the United States, except the Irish weren't officially slaves, but they were basically serfs still, serving in one of the big houses on the land, or owning businesses that catered to the needs of the big houses, owning businesses in garrison towns that catered to the needs of the British soldiers and barracks. And this isn't, you know, this is kind of ignoring all the exports that England relied on Ireland for. Part 1A, land reform. One of the biggest economic factors that contributed to Protestants leaving Ireland was land reform. Traditionally, the Protestants held more land than the Catholics in Ireland, but once the Windham Land Act of 1903 passed, that began to change. The Windham Land Act made it easier for tenants to purchase land, letting the government pay the difference between what the tenant offered and what the landlord asked for. It also gave more rights to tenants, breaking the hold landowners had over them. The Windham Land Act would be extended by the Land Purchase Ireland Act of 1909, beginning the end of Protestant dominance over Irish land. In total, 316,000 tenants purchased roughly 11.5 million acres out of a total of 20 million acres under these acts. The Irish Free Government would pass the Land Law Commission Act, 1923, which allowed the government to break large landholdings into smaller and smaller units of untenanted land, even if the division made the land uneconomical. And that was going to come back later to bite them in the ass, but it won them votes, so, you know. As we've mentioned before, Protestants were already migrating out of Ireland starting in 1911, most likely prompted by the Land Acts. Seeing where the wind was blowing, many Protestants must have figured out that it wouldn't be long before the Irish Free State would divvy out the remaining untenanted land. Many Protestants also no longer lived in Ireland or only lived on the island part-time, but still owned land. It didn't make sense to return to Ireland to take care of land they had trusted servants to manage while they were away, so they packed up and relocated, leaving their servants and tenants to fend for themselves. However, there were some people who did return to their land and wanted to hold it, and then that's where we get into the whole acts of violence thing. That being said, Protestant farmers and other agricultural workers had a better chance of staying and recovering from the economic shock than urban workers. According to Andy Bielenberg, the number of Protestant farmers and cattle dealers increased in 1926, with women farmers increasing by 32%. Many farmers who initially left returned, or they simply moved to another location in Ireland. Part 1b, Economic Life in Garrison Towns. Before the Anglo-Irish Treaty was signed, the life of a garrison town revolved around the presence of the British soldiers. They were also the same towns that were heavily impacted by IRA activity during the Irish War of Independence. The IRA often used risk of ambush to trap British soldiers within the confines of their towns, making the towns even more dependent on the British for their safety and economy. Either people served within the ranks of the army, of the civil service, or as members of the Royal Irish Constabulary, the RIC, or they worked in shops that served and supplied the barracks. When the British soldiers withdrew, the garrison towns saw the largest drop in total population as their economies collapsed. Many people followed the British soldiers during the initial withdrawal. Others left later, either because they couldn't find work elsewhere because of their association with the British Empire, or their businesses folded because of a lack of customers and or purposeful boycotts. Boycotts, a weapon the Irish used during the 1880 landlords, was also a weapon used against quote-unquote loyalists, pro-treaty people, and quote-unquote enemies of the Republic. Many Protestant stores in rural, Catholic-dominated areas, in particular, were very vulnerable to enforced boycotts and often left to either live in a city like Dublin, went north, or went elsewhere like England, the US, Australia, etc. Additionally, there were many industrial industries who saw a drop in profits after World War I and had to cut costs by shutting factories or limiting the products they produced. This led to economic changes all over the British Empire, including Ireland. For example, Kynoshes stopped making explosives at their plant in Arklow in 1918 when wartime demand fell. This forced many workers, including many Protestants, to find work elsewhere, contributing to relocation. Another worker, Herbert Hunter, a cereal breeder at Ballinacurra Cereal Station in County Cork, said he left because, quote, "The end of the war brought change in people and affairs, and I felt that for various reasons, some personal and others more difficult to define, that I should endeavor to extend my horizon." End quote is from Andy Bielenberg's article, Exodus, the Immigration of Southern Irish Protestants During the Irish War of Independence and the Civil War. During the British occupation, many Protestants enjoyed economic privileges. When the British left, they faced petty discrimination and purposeful exclusion. Bielenberg found that in County Donegal, 8 out of 37 rate collectors were Protestants before the treaty was signed. By 1924, there were no Protestant rate collectors. The post office saw a similar loss of all of its Protestant workers. So there was some discrimination going on. There's obviously a lot of migration, so those numbers could have dropped just because the people left. There's definitely intimidation going on as well. But we do see a significant drop in Protestant workers, specifically in civil services, and we'll talk a little bit later about one of the reasons why that may be. Part 2. Violent factors for mass Protestant immigration. While economic factors contributed to immigration, violence also played a factor. With the withdrawal of British forces, security fell onto the shoulders of the struggling provisional government. As we've mentioned before, the provisional government only controlled parts of Dublin. Large parts of rural Ireland were left in the hands of the anti-treaty IRA. This left minorities, particularly Protestants, vulnerable to violence, intimidation, and expulsion orders. From May 1921 to May 1922, the number of attacks against Protestants increased, the most famous being the Bandon Valley Massacre in April 1922, when 13 Protestants were shot in West Cork in the space of a few nights. Peter Hart argues that this was motivated primarily by sectarian antagonism, but that is a very contested opinion. In the Bandy Valley Massacre particularly, a number of targets had been actively opposed to the IRA or fraternized with Crown forces, or at least that was the claim. Other victims seemed to have been shot because they were an acceptable proxy for the real target. This isn't to downplay the role of sectarianism in these violent attacks, but to highlight the many conflicting motives that contribute to these types of actions. It also seems that many Protestants who initially fled the area following the massacre later returned to their homes. Why were Protestants targeted? There's definitely merit to the idea of sectarian violence. Basically, Protestants are dangerous because they are not Catholic and not, quote-unquote, really Irish. There's also an argument to be made that particularly the anti-treaty IRA were still fighting the last war. They really wanted to fight the British Empire and not their own people, the provisional government, and so the Protestants weren't just citizens, they were potential spies and collaborators. There's definitely some scapegoating going on. And we can even think of Collins' campaign in Northern Ireland, right? He's like, oh, let's use Northern Ireland as a uniting tool. What is Northern Ireland? Protestant, unionist, right? Quote unquote, not Irish. So there's definitely this train of thought of like, let's just use the people who aren't like us to unite our warring forces and everything will be fine. Somehow, the anti-treaty IRA believed the Protestants were poisoning the land and culture, keeping Ireland trapped within England's control. The betrayal by former IRA heroes like Michael Collins was hard to accept, and even he was accused of being a puppet for England. If someone with Collins' revolutionary credentials could be attacked for being owned by the British, then many Protestants didn't stand a chance. Finally, people wanted to take revenge for old hurts, or simply saw an opportunity to clear the land of its current occupants and open it up for redistribution. I will also add that while this episode focuses specifically on the fate of Irish Protestants, Catholics who quote-unquote betrayed the cause were similarly targeted, which undercuts the sectarian argument a bit. Also, while the assumption is that the violence was driven by the anti-treaty IRA, there are also accounts of Free State soldiers harassing citizens as well as opportunists who used the British withdrawal and approaching civil war as cover for their own actions. Part 2A, house burning. Ireland has a long history of agrarian violence, so it made sense that a lot of violence against the Protestants was centered around destroying the big houses, attacking grazers who needed large tracts of undeveloped land for their cattle, and maiming and killing livestock. Gemma Clark studied everyday violence perpetuated in the Tipperary, Limerick, and Waterford counties during the Irish Civil War. It's a really good book. I highly recommend it. She found that the most common type of everyday violence was arson, intimidation, kidnapping, executions, sexual violence, and assault. For arson, she found 2,018 compensation claims related specifically to arson. So basically what she did is that she looked at all the compensation claims that were made after the war, particularly during the Civil War period, and she was like, oh, okay, so these are all arson related, these are all intimidation related, you know, this is sexual violence related, and then she kind of stretched her study around what she found. So out of those 2018 compensation claims, it seems that there were 108 incidences of arson in Limerick, 164 cases in Tipperary, and 20 cases in Waterford. So I just want to highlight again, these are just numbers that people made a claim for. There probably were a lot more that people just didn't bother. Out of those numbers, we have the following statistics. Of the 108 arson cases in Limerick, 41% involved crops and or outhouses, 21% involved small to medium-sized private houses, 16% involved burning down other property, such as vehicles, goods in transit, personal items, etc., 9% involved big houses, 7% involved barracks, former RIC or Free State, 6% included public building or businesses. Of the 164 arson cases in Tipperary, 28% of them involved crops and or outhouses, 18% of them involved burning down other property, such as vehicles, goods in transit, and personal items, etc., 16% involved small to medium-sized private houses, 15% included big houses, 13% involved barracks, either RIC or Free State, and then 10% involved public building or businesses. And then finally, out of the 20 arson cases in Waterford, 45% involved crops and or outhouses, 25% involved burning down other property such as vehicles, goods in transit, personal items, etc., 20% involved small to medium-sized private houses, and then 10% involved the big houses. One of the reasons arson was popular was because it destroyed infrastructure, making the pro-treaty and Protestant lives harder and undermining people's faith in the Free State government. If the Free State couldn't protect them from arsonists and anti-treaty IRA, then what were they good for? However, it also served as a continuation of the land wars. Given the fact that the British were leaving, it was safe to assume that meant land would be redistributed, especially since that was a big issue for Sinn Féin. They ran on it. Like, that was their platform, and that's what helped them win the 1918 election. So the logic went that if the big houses were burnt, it would force the quote-unquote loyalist, quote-unquote Protestants, and quote-unquote anti-Republican Irish people to flee and open the land up for claiming, even if the house itself was destroyed. While it's tempting to assume that a lot of arson was perpetrated by opportunists using the chaos of the Civil War to settle old scores and take what they thought they deserved, it was also a deliberate strategy implemented with military precision. And if you had listened to my episode on Liam Lynch, you could already see by 1921, 1922, Liam Lynch and many others were becoming more radical. They were talking about executing Protestants for every IRA prisoner still in jail. He was talking about burning houses. I think it's like beginning of 1921, beginning of 1922, the IRA do burn several barracks, like 100, I think maybe 200 barracks, something like that. So already we see this thinking taking hold towards the tail end of the Irish War of Independence, and it made sense that the anti-treaty IRA would pick that up during the Irish Civil War. Arson caused terror, took away big buildings that could be used by Free State troops and loyalists, or quote-unquote loyalists, and undermined the Free State's hold on security and order. It also destroyed infrastructure needed to supply troops, ship troops and goods around the country, and hurt businesses. O'Higgins himself would claim that arson was just one of the many tools used by the anti-treaty side to hurt the free Irish state. Quote, a conspiracy has existed against this state for 10 months. Its methods are open and apparent. Arson, assassination, general sabotage, war in the economic life of the country, the burning of commercial vans, the mining of picture houses, and attempting to blow up a business establishments. End quote is from Gemma Clark's book, Everyday Violence in the Irish Civil War. When arson didn't work, then anti-treaty IRA intimidated, harassed, assaulted, and eventually killed supporters of the Free State, quote-unquote, loyalists, and anyone who threatened an Irish Republic, whether they be Catholics or Protestants. This could involve threatening notes, expulsion orders, raids, kidnappings, assault, sexual and otherwise, and eventual executions. It also involved the destruction of property, sometimes through arson, as well as animal abuse, maiming, and death, especially cattle and livestock that farmers relied on for their living. In urban areas, this also included the destruction of goods and storefronts. One of the reasons livestock was targeted connected back to the idea of land redistribution. There was a concept of grazers, people who owned large tracts of land to graze their cattle, and many people thought this land to be redistributed, so they attacked the cattle to hurt the farmer's business and force them out, and then they could take the land. Part 3. Whose culture is it? While it would be misleading to claim that the provisional government and later the Free State government purposely tried to eradicate what the Protestant community saw as quote-unquote their culture, it's true that the government did all it could to reassert a Gaelic Catholic culture, one many believe the British had destroyed with their invasion and eventual colonization. One of the biggest bones of contention between the Irish government and the Protestants, the revival of Gaelia, also known as the Gaelic language, pulsory, Gaelia in primary schools was one of the first things introduced by the Irish government. It became a key factor in many jobs. By 1925, proficiency was required to enter the civil service, defense, the police force, and the legal world. And this is why we can see a drop of Protestants in civil service jobs like the post office. This created an economic barrier for many Protestants who had no love for the language and no interest in learning it. They even argued that it wasted time in the classroom, preventing students from learning more quote-unquote relevant subjects. While the Free State government never meant to be against other religions, the dominance of Catholicism also put the Protestant minority on edge. That combined with the shrinking Protestant spaces because of mass immigration, and it's no surprise that many Protestants felt they were being asked to assimilate to a culture that wasn't theirs. As violence wound down and economic opportunities stabilized, the feeling of living in a quote-unquote alien culture seems to have been a driving factor for immigration after the Civil War. In conclusion, this is a very complicated topic, and I hope that you enjoy this episode. I tried to provide as many different explanations and different sides of the issue as possible, and I've tried to be respectful. So like the Northern Ireland episode that I just posted a couple weeks ago, this was another really hard one for me because I wanted to be very balanced while also acknowledging, you know, the realities of the different bigotries and different thoughts on both sides. So hopefully you enjoyed this. Again, I won't feel bad if you have thoughts that you want to put in a review. That's fine. If you did enjoy this, though, and you want to listen to my full catalog on Spotify, iTunes, and my website, www.samswarroom.com, that would be awesome. Also, please join my Patreon. at www.patreon.com/AOAwarfare to keep up to date on all my projects and also to support me during this difficult time. Until next time, wear a mask, organize with your community, and stay safe.